All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. WTF, welcome to it. How's everybody doing? Things seem to be slowly and belligerently opening up here in California. I guess if you decide it's okay, it's okay. Magical thinking. It's amazing that given the small window of opportunity to get a little back to normal without any real information being dispersed in an appropriate kind of blanket way around this virus, that just a little crumb that we might be able to get back to some sort of at least phase one of something. Some business is opening. It's amazing how quickly a large number of people just decide it's over. It's over. I am grateful that my industry is continuing to be cautious, because it's so not over. And just the belligerence of it. I get it. We're tired of this. The inconvenience, the lack of work, the inability to get out and do things. But that doesn't mean you can decide it's gone, and it is. It's amazing how quickly people surrender their intelligence, their memory, their common sense when they've had enough. It's scary, really, how that can be applied. Today on the show, I talked to Joey Pantoliano. Great. It's great. Got a movie coming out called From the Vine. It will be on VOD next month. But you know him from everything. He's been in everything. And I know some of you may have heard that he got into a little accident. Well, I tell you, you know, I'm feeling okay in this half hour, in this process of missing and mourning or grieving or just Lynn Shelton. I also want to tell you that there's a beautiful hour-long or so tribute that's up on YouTube that her friend Megan did, called Her Effortless Brilliance, A Celebration of Lynn Shelton. You can watch that on YouTube. It's got a lot of the actors and all, you know, someone from most of her movies, and then musicians from all the films that did the soundtrack work doing a song. It's a beautiful thing. Her Effortless Brilliance, A Celebration of Lynn Shelton. You can find that on YouTube. So Joey Pants got into a bad accident, and you know, like days after I talked to him, I talked to Joey Pants before Lynn passed away. And after she passed, he wrote me an email. Dear Mark, I've been talking like I'm from Jersey. Dear Mark, I'm deeply sorry to hear of your unthinkable loss. I only heard yesterday and was devastated for you. We listened to you talk with Lynn Shelton yesterday, looking at pictures. She was so beautiful. She seemed to shine. I'm so glad you found each other and had that special time with each other. I don't know if this will help, but I want to tell you an antidote to our talk a couple of Thursdays ago. I recall at some point talking about the benefits that I've experienced from COVID-19, that I've been spending much more time with my wife and adult kids, taking long walks, discovering hikes close to our house. Well, the following afternoon, we ventured out after a long rain Thursday night into Friday. It was still drizzling, but the fog was clearing, and I love walking in the rain. We were walking to the corner of the main road when a cloud opened and this amazing rainbow just popped out, one of those double rainbows. So beautiful, I stopped and took my phone, did a little video, and posted it on Instagram less than 100 yards from the corner where I was to cross. There was a woman about to make a left-hand turn onto our street, waiting for oncoming traffic. Because of the rainbow, Nancy and the kids had gotten 30 yards ahead of me. The kids had already crossed the street, and Nancy was on opposite corner from me. This lady sees me and waves. I instinctively wave back. I don't know her, but I think she knows me from show business. Guess she's happy to spot me. She's so happy, she keeps her eyes on me while she decides to commit to that left-hand turn into an oncoming suburban SUV doing 50 miles an hour. The guy didn't even have time to hit his brakes. T-bones her, slamming her with all that energy into me. I was hit up into the air and through a wooden three-post fence head first. EMT, concussion, and 10 stitches in my head. Torn meniscus, bad shoulder and back. I was a mess. I couldn't stand up. That should have killed me. No fucking rhyme or reason to why it didn't. Life. The love and pain and agony and the ecstasy of this journey. So few of us are lucky enough to have a dream, have the gumption to go after it, and then be lucky enough to have them come true. Some of us get to realize those dreams and more. You two were kissed by a rainbow. I'm so happy you found each other and had each other, held each other, loved each other. God bless you, your families, and may she rest in peace. Our family mourns your loss. Deepest sympathy, Joey Pants. I read that because, I've been getting a lot of condolence emails and a lot of support from all of you, but I read that because I was going to tell you what happened to him, you know, a couple of days after we talked, but I figured I'd put it into that context, and it came in the form of that condolence letter. I'm not giving any of you short shrift. You guys have all been great. Thank you so much for continuing to be checking in on me. So many people checking in on me. I guess you know in grief, or I don't know, everyone tells me there's no right way to do it, but I guess you know that you're getting a little better when, you know, you're grateful for all the support, you're crying, you're spending time meditating, processing, praying, remembering. And then one day you think like, hey, why the fuck didn't that guy check in with me? Why didn't I didn't get anything from him or her? Why wouldn't they send their condolences? As soon as he's in the midst of thousands of well-wishing, beautiful people trying to, you know, show me that I'm supported in this, one day the brain goes like, I didn't hear from that guy. I've known him forever. And then you're like, all right, something's changing. But then I have to frame it. I got to frame it with the new wisdom, you know, the new wisdom. It's all right. Would I have reached out? You know, do you know what to say? Some people don't know what to say. Some people don't want to say anything. Someday you run into them, they'll say, I didn't know what to say. And, you know, it's not vindictive. No one owes anybody anything. Death is fucking weird and horrible. But it happens to everybody. I am getting a little, I'm not tired of it, but I start to understand, you know, why grief or death makes people uncomfortable. I mean, I have neighbors who I don't even know that well. And they're like, how you doing? And I just start weeping. And they're standing there and I'm like, I'm all right, I'm okay. You know, it just it happens. There's something, I'm sort of happy that, you know, I have time to deal with this. You know, cooking and eating. Monkey's okay, Buster's okay. I use my Traeger grill a lot. But you know when you use a Traeger grill a lot, when you use a wood pellet grill, I don't know if you guys experience this. Will you just tell me this? Is it just common? Like when you have a regular grill, a charcoal grill and grease or grizzle or whatever gets on the thing, you just kind of scrape it off or it falls into the coals and it just burns up like grease. But with this wood pellets, this is what I want to ask anyone who has a wood pellet grill. Does it create this fucking like petroleum looking sludge that expands, you know, when you try to clean it off of anything? It's just like, I think it's all the sediment in the smoke mixing with the grease from the cooking. It creates a kind of tar, but it's like, it's viscous. It's not, I wish it was more solid. It's just this, it's like oil and it spreads like oil. It's the one downside. Is that just my grill or is that something that happens? That's the big question. That's what I'm worrying about right now. My brain locks on to shit. You know what else is beautiful? You know when I talked about the hawk's nest and all the bird shit on my cars in my driveway? Well, there's like two baby hawks. I think there's two baby hawks and a mother hawk up there, and I just see them kind of hanging out. I guess they're learning how to be hawks. And it's pretty stunning. It's a pretty beautiful thing. I wish I had some binoculars. I used to have some. I don't know what happened to them. But I've been watching them. One of the baby hawks ended up in one of my little trees out front, and I saw it there. And this is where I'm at. Like, the hawk was there, and I'm like, oh, fuck. Is this hawk fucked up? Do I got a fucked up baby bird of prey in my little tree here? Why isn't he up there with the other ones, with his family? I just started looking at it. I'm like, are you fucked up? Because I can't handle a fucked up bird your size. I don't know what I'll do. The sadness of it will just fucking kill me. And I just sat there and looked at it, and I was like, well, maybe he's just hanging out. Birds just hang out. It's not like he's got somewhere to go, really. But if he's fucked up, I'm not going to be able to deal with it. So I think I'm going to go in the house for a while, come back out later to see if it's gone, and just hope it's gone and not on my lawn with some sort of fucked up wing or head or foot or whatever. I just couldn't deal with it. I just taken the goddamn cat to the vet. I don't know what I would do with a baby hawk with a broken wing, you know? I'm going to put that in a box and bring it to the fucking vet. I just couldn't. Well, that's where my brain went. But I came out. And he's gone. He's up there. I saw him this morning, him and his sibling and the mother hanging out. Joey Pants. Joey Pantoliano. Ralphie from The Sopranos. He was in the Matrix movie. He's been in everything. All right. And, you know, as I said before, he's got From the Vine, a film that'll be on VOD next month. And, you know, I talked to Joey Pants and I loved it. Jersey, that talk is coming right up. It's nice to meet you, Joe.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
How are you holding up? Where are you, in Los Angeles? Are you here?
No, I'm in Connecticut. We live in Connecticut.
Oh, and really?
Perfect, yeah.
Are you going crazy?
No, because, you know, we live, I have 3 acres. I got three of my four adult kids here.
Yeah.
Plus a wife and a boyfriend, and we're taking walks. You know, the first 14 days we were in isolation, and now it's just we're with each other.
Right.
We take walks.
Wait, so your wife has a boyfriend? Is that what you're telling me?
No, my daughter's boyfriend.
that sounds pretty exciting. You're a really open-minded guy.
Yeah, we're very, very liberal-minded here in Connecticut. You know, it's really bizarre. It's weird. It's fucking crazy. Normally, I pretty much live on the couch anyway. I mean, I've been isolated for the last 12 years, but this thing, we're starting to pop at the scene. People are getting crazy. Some of my friends are going crazy.
Yeah.
I got yelled at by a lady in the supermarket last week. They put these tapes on the floor. So this goes straight and no two carts at the same time anymore. And I didn't know. And lady screaming at me about I'm going the wrong way, and I didn't see the line, so I don't know what she's talking about.
Yeah.
You know, it's like being a vampire, you know. It's like back away.
It's crazy, man. But you're staying in touch with friends and everything?
The thing that I've noticed is I'm talking to my friends on the phone again.
Yeah.
You know, for the last 2 or 3 years, everybody's kind of texting each other. There's no connection.
Right.
You know, my phone didn't ring.
Right.
That's a good thing. And, you know, some of my friends have gotten, some of my friends died. You know, I have 3 friends that died, and 7 of them are still in the hospital. But the thing.
Of the coronavirus?
Yeah.
How many died?
Well, 5 people I know died.
Oh my God.
And 3 were, you know, good friends.
In New York?
Well, one was in Florida. One was 81.
Yeah.
And he had like what they would call pre-existing conditions.
Right.
You know, one friend got sick and they thought it was you know, stomach blockage. It turned out it was before they shut down. I was doing a play in New York, and it was before they shut down the theater.
Yeah,
all the theaters, and so it was diagnosed as a stomach thing. It turned out to probably have been the corona, but he didn't die. Everybody's frightened, and nobody's saying that they're frightened, so they're arguing. There's arguments about things that have no relevancy because they're cooped up and concerned.
Yeah, man, it's devastating. I'm sorry you lost your friend in that. I have not, you know, that so many people on the East Coast, I guess all over, are being personally affected. My mother's friend got it, but she's got through it. But I don't know anybody personally out here.
Yeah.
Yet, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I can't believe that you spend a lot of time on the couch. It looks like you're working every fucking minute.
It's the only reason why I work is to get off the goddamn couch. You know, it's like, well, if I don't say yes, then I'll be on the couch. How many times can you watch Casablanca?
Well, I mean, is that why a lot of times you, I mean, have you made movies you don't even remember doing?
Yes. And I've been seeing them. I, you know, literally you see stuff and you go, I don't remember. But, you know, recently my friend Andy Davis, who directed The Fugitive, and we did three movies together. And we did a movie with Andy Garcia and Alan Arkin called Steal Big, Steal Little. And I always told him I didn't understand the movie. So he sent me the movie. It was like the Blu-ray. And he says, this movie is so up to date. You know, it's so relevant to today and what's going on. And it is.
Yeah.
But I saw there were scenes. There's a whole sequence where I'm in drag.
Yeah.
Literally, I'm just in full drag. I don't remember shooting it. I don't remember shooting it. I don't remember anything about it.
Wait, how is that possible, Joe?
Well, I was a drug addict and an alcoholic, so that might have something to do with it.
You were able to work on, you know, drunk and work on drugs. What was the drugs? What drugs did you like?
Well, actually, no, I wasn't really drunk when I worked.
Yeah,
I would get drunk when I got home.
Right.
But my favorite drug was painkillers, oxycodone.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as it turned out, that, you know, I talk about this in my second book, but, you know, I had seven deadly symptoms.
Yeah.
Right.
And
my first drug of choice was food. So when I was 14, I wound up becoming a house. I put on 100 pounds, and I wanted the girls to like me. So I started starving myself, and that had a whole different effect. The idea that I could go to bed, you know, I could stop eating at 7 and go to bed and wake up in the morning having accomplished that goal of not eating, and the feeling that it gave me, I really loved that feeling. And then, you know, success for a long time was a drug of choice. That and all of this was like to escape this feeling that was living in here, so that if I could become successful, this would go away. Or if I could, you know, if I could sleep with the beautiful actress, model, whatever, this would go away.
What was it? What's that? What is that? The sadness inside, you mean?
Yeah. Well, I, you know, intellectually, I didn't know that it was sadness, that it was, you know, overwhelming depression.
Right.
I didn't know that. I just knew that I didn't like the way it felt, and that if I achieved this, that this would change, and this never changed.
I just felt it. I just felt, because I'm sober myself, but I just felt like when you talking about that, you know, I just felt that weird rush of relief that you literally feel in your heart when you eat a piece of cake or do a fucking line of blow or fuck somebody. I just felt it.
Yeah.
And I don't usually feel it, but yeah, there was something about the way you were communicating it. How do you are you a sober guy, or you just done with that shit?
No, I do a lot of things, but you know, it's like one thing I realized is I'm far from sober. I mean, I'm a fucking lunatic, you know. So I don't do drugs, and I don't drink alcohol.
Yeah.
And I don't alter my chemistry, but I'm absolutely out of my mind.
Yeah, I mean, you can get off on anything, right? You know, anger, food, whatever. So wait, how'd you grow up? How did you come from it? You come from a depression?
There was a lot of trauma in my family. It was handed out to me. My mother, you know, my mother hated her father, and she hated men, and even the men that she loved. She that self-fulfilling prophecy where she would go after to get them to pop, And when they went, and when we would pop, she would start singing "Who's Sorry Now" in bad voice. She was a terrible singer, but to, as a challenge, smoke 4 packs of cigarettes a day, and she'd go "Who's Sorry Now?" Like I won, you know, I won.
After
fuck
she gets
you, I won.
After you, after she pushed you over the edge,
over the edge, and she did that with my father and her third cousin lover. Who ultimately turned out to be my biological father.
Why, what?
Yeah, until what I was 20, 60, I was 64 years old when I finally found out, I got absolute evidence with that 23andMe that I did it because my sister was giving me all kinds of shit that why did I say that cousin Flory might be daddy, and so I was staying with a friend. He said, you know, there's this thing, 23andMe, that'll shut her up.
Yeah.
So I sent the kit to her and we both spit in the tubes and it came back, said I was, you know, she was my half sister.
Oh my God. So that's just a few years ago?
Yeah, that was a few years ago.
Oh my God. So wait, you grew up in New Jersey?
Yeah, I grew up in Hoboken, New Jersey, small town.
Yeah, yeah. It was a small town then. Now it's a hipster town. Back then it was, what, was it mostly Italian?
It was multi-ethnic, you know, very diverse. But, I mean, it's like, it's only a mile square and there's something like 45, 50,000 people live there. Now it's a very wealthy community now.
Yeah, it got all redone and everything. So what was the family business?
Well, you know, my father, Monk, Dominic Pantaleano, he was a foreman, but he was a degenerate gambler. So. Yeah. And so was my mother. So was everybody. You know, everybody was always playing the numbers. Always, you know, it was the Daily Double. And Flory, cousin Flory, I remember.
Your real dad.
Yes, yes. Like Aunt Lizzie, his mother, who my mom would take me to the city every, you know, on the weekends to say, see Aunt Lizzie.
Right.
I realized, then I found out that Aunt Lizzie was my grandmother. You know,
so wait,
at 62, I had to do the math then.
How are they related? How is Flory a cousin?
Flory was a callow. My mother's mother's side.
Yeah, yeah.
So and then Aunt Lizzie was my mother's second cousin. My grandmother was my, you know. So and point of fact, my grandmother was also my fourth cousin.
But everyone's a degenerate gambler, so that's one of the bugs,
right?
Right?
Absolutely.
You didn't get that one?
No, because you know we'd have to sneak out in the dark of night to beat the landlord that was, you know, putting liens on us. You know, my mom would, you know, I was born in 51, so if they shut off our telephone, which was a constant every 80 days, they'd shut it off. And then she'd get the daily news and go through the obituary and see who died and say, okay, yeah, hello, this is Mrs. Sullivan. I just moved to 701 Adams Street. I need to get my phone turned on. And that's...
She'd use the dead person's name? Or the wife that...
she would get $5 a vote. We would go to all of the polls because she said, listen, dead people have as much a right to vote as people that are alive. And she would go and find people. You ever see the movie The Great McGinty, Preston Sturges? Oh, my God, you got to see this movie. It's fantastic. But you know, that's what we would do because the whole thing, that saying, all politics is local politics, has a way bigger meaning for me.
Oh, because she'd get paid by a candidate to vote for dead people.
Yeah, and you get your guy in on the third ward to be an alderman, and you know now they had some power, so Uncle Popeye became the dog catcher. Uncle Popeye was also the town drunk, so he would forget that he had dead dogs in the trunk.
Is that
and
serious?
Then when we'd go down the Jersey Shore, we you know the kids, none of us wanted to be in Uncle Popeye's car because it smelled of those terrible Tampico cigars and dead rotted dogs in the trunk. You couldn't get the smell out.
So you didn't want to go to the beach with him, huh? Didn't want to go down to Jersey Shore with Uncle Popeye?
Yeah, Long Branch. Yeah, we didn't want to do that.
So when do you get, like, and your father, they're both gambling. God, you're so fucking lucky. I tell you, man, as a guy who did drugs and drank and sex and whatever, the gambling one, I'm so glad I never got that.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it's crazy. I don't even understand where the fun in it is. You know what
well,
I mean?
That's like, the thing. There is no fun in it. There's no fun. I mean, the thing is, what I had to learn was that it was the aggravation, the that rage, that fear, the confusion, that was visceral. That I could feel. That
yeah.
That reminded me of home. But this whole idea of serenity, that
right.
I couldn't pick serenity out in a lineup. You know, it's like what has no feeling.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Who needs that?
Anger and rage is a much more visceral feeling than love.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so, do you have to constantly kind of, because I find as I get older, because I have an anger problem too, but like, yeah, you start to realize you hurt people, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like, does it have to be said? Does it have to be said now? Does it have to be said by me? I talk a lot less now. Okay. Now I have nothing to add.
In that way, everybody stays around. They don't.
Yeah.
You don't end up alone yelling at nothing.
Yeah.
So when do you just have the one sister?
I have my sister, Marianne. Yeah. Marianne. And then I got four kids. They're all adults and four grandboys in Las Vegas. My daughter's in the restaurant business there.
Oh, in Vegas. You go out there a lot?
To see the kids. I hate Vegas. I've always hated it.
I hate it too. You mean you hated it when it was nice before it got shitty?
I hated it. Yeah, I hated it when, you know, the old Vegas.
Yeah.
Because I think maybe because of the gambling.
Yeah.
I just don't like the desert. I don't know. It's like
too bleak.
Yeah, everything looks alike.
Yeah.
You go by the mall, and they got a dentist there. They got an eye place. They got the Pizza Hut. It's all the same.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So you've been living on the East Coast your whole life.
Yeah, well, I lived in L.A. For 20 years. When I went to California in 77, somehow wound up in Venice and lived around there. And then, you know, when my daughter was like 16, her grades weren't so hot. And I said, look, I don't want to live here anymore. I don't have to. I never work here, but they hire me. I get on an airplane. I could do that back east, and I hear the schools in Connecticut are good. So either you get your act together, or we're moving. So we wound up moving, and then after the first semester, she wound up becoming a honor student again. And I said, "What changed?" And she said, "Well, I guess it's cool to be smart here."
Yeah. Thank God, it's a good call on your behalf.
Yeah.
So how did you start? How do you start the business? How do you start acting? Did you go to New York? Where'd you go?
Yeah, my Flory had a friend that knew an actor.
Not your father. Not your mother's husband. The uncle.
Yeah, cousin Flory.
You call
cousin
him your father Flory. Now?
Well, I called him my father. I called them both my father after a while.
Okay.
When he got out of prison, he lived with us, and then Mommy threw Daddy out of the house, and Flory stayed.
Oh, so he was actually there when you were a kid.
He was there until I was like, he'd come and visit, and then I remember him. I have memories of him coming to the house and playing with me, and then I remember my mom taking me to the federal holding facility. He'd been convicted of what I didn't know at the time, and saying goodbye, touching the glass and talking on the telephone. I was 7 years old. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah. What do you get? And what was he in prison for?
The last thing was, drug trafficking. He was a wise guy. That's,
yeah.
You know, like I wanted to be an actor. He wanted to be a wise guy. That's what he wanted to be.
And he was. Okay, so how did he inspire your acting?
He said every move I ever made in my life was the wrong move.
Yeah.
So don't fuck up your life like I fucked up my life. The energy that I put into doing this shit, you could take that energy in a positive way. And if you put your mind to it, if this is what you want to do, because he saw me in the high school play, he said, if this is what you want to do, and there's nothing that can stop you. He said, remember, those fucking movie stars, they wipe their ass twice a day if they're lucky.
Yeah.
And so it was what I wanted to do. And I met a guy who said, go down to HB Studios. And that's how I've been incredibly lucky in my life to meet mentors, you know, people that had something that I wanted, you know, like they say in the 12-step program, that saw something in me that I didn't know existed and guided me.
It was HB Studios?
HB Studios. There was a guy named Al Sinkes. He wasn't even a teacher. Really talented guy, you know, and I got to stage manage on shows that he directed. And
that was in New York?
Yeah, down on Bank Street.
Okay.
And also teachers like my speech therapy teacher there and other teachers that followed after him and just, you know, other people, you know, like the Wallachs, Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson, because I was in school with their daughter, Roberta, and they took me and introduced me to my first agent and working my, just those little teeny breaks, a series of those little thousand little breaks that you get.
So what was it? So in high school, you did some acting, but what was the first stuff you did in New York?
See, when I decided to be an actor, I was my last year in high school, and I was, I don't know, 4 months shy of being 19 years old because I was undiagnosed dyslexic. They didn't have dyslexia then. It was either you're stupid, lazy, or crazy.
Right.
You know, so I didn't know how to read. I didn't learn how to read because I was embarrassed. It was so difficult, and I just took an attitude. It was one of the reasons why I wanted to be in show business is I thought you didn't need how to read.
Yeah.
You need to learn how to.
Right.
What do you need to read for? That looks easy. I've been lying my whole life. And so, that, you know, my teacher said, if you want to do this, you have an aptitude for this, you're going to need to learn how to read. So I was diagnosed. I found a teacher, an elementary school teacher that evaluated me and said I had a third grade reading level. So those first two or three years at HB Studios, I used to find off Broadway, and I would audition for little plays that had no repercussions. That I could fall on my nose and nobody would give a shit. They weren't going anywhere, and I wasn't going anywhere.
Right.
And so I did a lot of these little basement plays as I started to learn how to read. And
it's a crazy time, right? It was basement plays. It must have been pretty wild, though. It was the 60s, right? Or what? Early 70s?
Early 70s. Yeah. But listen, my rent was $106 a month.
Right.
I was weighing tables three times a week and living like a king. I was making, you know, $140 a week.
Yeah.
I had a lot of money. I don't know how these kids do it today.
Yeah. So you're doing the little plays in the basement. You're learning how to read. You're waiting tables.
Weighing tables. And you get lucky. And I got to play a national tour of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Who'd you play?
I played Billy Bibbit.
Oh, wow.
And then I got another production of that with Robert Forster, a summer tour.
Who did he play?
McMurphy.
Oh, no kidding, huh?
Yeah, he is another one that just, you know, saw something in me and introduced me to people, and I got to hang out with him and get to know him, and he was great. He was absolutely great. And I just then I got my SAG card.
For what?
I did a Joseph Strick movie. Barry Bostwick was in it. Regina Baff. Robert Dreyfuss. I was thug number two.
Uh-huh.
And I did that. And I would see guys that were in my acting class on television that they were, there was this whole exodus of people that were going to New York, from New York to Los Angeles. And they were on, like, you know, Police Story and I Shied and Kojak. And I'm thinking, if those guys can get jobs, I can get a job.
Yeah.
So I saved up enough money with my then girlfriend. $1,500 each, and we got on an airplane.
So you go out, and then you start doing TV in LA. Is that what happens?
Yeah, I got really lucky really quick. I was there a couple of months, and back in those days, you had to audition. You know, there was a casting director named Eddie Foy III, who was, I guess, the grandkid of Eddie Foy, the famous comedian.
Yeah.
And he worked at ABC. He was a casting guy, head of casting, I guess. And my girlfriend got an audition. We did a scene from a play, and he thought I was right for something and recommended me for this pilot with John Biner, this TV show that we're doing at ABC, John Biner.
Yeah, another comedian.
Yeah, and yeah. I wound up getting that job.
Yeah.
And that was at Columbia TV.
What was that called?
That was called McNamara's Band.
Oh, okay.
At that Bernie Kukoff and Jeff Harris and Harry Columbi wrote that. I think it wound up turning into Johnny Dangerously, the Michael Keaton movie years later.
Oh, yeah.
Then Columbia TV, I got hired by Rob Reiner for a TV series that he did, a half-hour show after All in the Family, called Free Country. And it took place, it was a turn-of-the-century sitcom.
Yeah.
We did five of those. And from that, Columbia TV was doing the remake of From Here to Eternity, a six-hour miniseries, and I got that.
Did you play the trumpet player?
No, Pruitt. No, I wanted to I played Angelo Maggio, the part.
Oh, of course,
you know,
right.
Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
Which was funny because he was from Hoboken too.
Yeah. Did you ever meet that guy?
I met Sinatra from afar, but he had sent his guy, Mickey Rudin was his attorney. And at the party, the premiere party, Rudin introduced himself to me, and I was such an idiot. He said, you know, I've represented your predecessor for the last 30 years, and I didn't know what a predecessor was.
Yeah.
And I said, what's a predecessor? He said, it's Frank Sinatra. I said, no kidding. I said, you know, his father and my grandfather were firemen together. He goes, I know all about it. I said, what are you going to tell Sinatra? He says, I'm going to tell him you did all right. But I was too nervous to meet him.
You're too nervous to meet Frank?
Yeah.
Did he yells that much? He yells a big place in Hoboken.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was another reason, like my friends in the acting class, if Sinatra could get out, so could I. It was a way to get out.
Yeah.
You know, they made On the Waterfront in Hoboken. It was a way to get out. A lot of the guys were extras that were in the movie, you know, so it was like, shit, yeah, I'll be an actor. That'll be a way to get out.
So you're doing television in the 70s there. And then, like, the movie thing, when does that take off? Like, I didn't realize you were in that Idolmaker movie. I kind of remember that movie.
Well, what happens is you meet people, and you have, like, in that case, Rita Riggs was the costume designer on All in the Family, and she did the thing with Rob, Free Country. And so Taylor Hackford was his first film, and he was staying at her place. She had this beautiful warehouse apartment on 3rd Street. So she said, hey, there's a guy I just worked with, Joey. You should bring him in. And so that's how I got that job.
Yeah. And you sort of establish yourself as a certain frequency because you're a singular guy, singular talent. And it just seems like, you know, at any role that I've ever seen you in my entire life, it's just like, which frequency of me do you need? Do you want me, how high do you want me to turn this up?
It's so true. It's sad, but true.
Like, you're like, you want a little bit or you want the full thing? You want the full thing? but no, it's great because, you know, no one can be you. But that was the first movie. The first big movie was The Idolmaker?
I think so.
When do you, like, outside of just doing the work, I mean, when do you realize, I guess it must have been Risky Business, where you're like, I'm a guy now. People know me. I'm on the street. They recognize me.
I thought that was the case when I did From Here to Eternity. And then I didn't work for 18 months and I was waiting tables again.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah.
Oh, shit, that's the worst.
In New York, you could get away with it.
Yeah.
I was always just trying to pay the rent. You know, I was always, you know, just like the drive. I was motivated by fear. Fear, and it's always the last job. I'm never going to work again.
Right.
And I never wanted to get too attached. It was like I didn't want to have to say goodbye. I hate saying goodbye. So when movies were over, it was horrible. You know, it was a hard. Those last days are always horrible because it just you got to say goodbye, and you know, and it's
you get attached.
Well, it's like this kind of concentrate. You get there, you show up, and this one's your wife, and that one's your lover, and this is your brother, and so you. It's like instant. It's instantaneous.
Right.
And I have then a you family. Never see them again.
Yeah. Like I have a family, and then they're gone.
And they're gone. So it's. But I just love the noise of it, the distraction, the moment of clarity in between action and cut. You know, it's like I always kind of. So I never knew who I was.
Yeah.
You know, I liked the idea that I could invent somebody that I wanted to be like. You know, I think one of the reasons why I'm so convincing at playing bad guys is because I was so bullied as a kid because I was fat. I was always getting my ass kicked because I was an easy target. These bastards would see me and they just start smacking me around. And so I never when I could never stand up for myself. So seeing those guys in my mind's eye when I was playing these scenes, a lot of times I was getting even with these bastards 30 years later.
No kidding.
My doctor said I was sublimating unresolved feelings.
So by playing the bad guys, you were able to beat the bad guy.
Yeah. Or the bad guy that, you know,
kicked your ass when you were
humiliated me. You know, that's a terrible feeling to be humiliated like that,
to be embarrassed,
shamed. Yeah. And you think you're weak, you think it's you.
So you knew all these guys, you're very familiar with bullies from the other side of it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know, and that's why Trump bugs me so much.
Oh, he's a real deal.
Nasty, lying, you know, guy that had to have been bullied his whole fucking life.
I don't know. Was he though? I mean, he seems to just, I think he's just kind of a sociopathic narcissist. I don't think he ever got, I think he always just sat there and, you know, waited for his moment to.
No, I think you gotta be creative. You gotta be hurt that bad to be that isolated. And
his old man, it must've been his old man.
Had to be his old man.
Yeah.
Yeah, had to be.
But your family, you didn't get it from your family, did you?
No, I mean, my mother was
right, right.
My mother was, you know, the shit that she'd say, the stuff that she would say to us, you know, and then, but she was damaged, you know. She had a terrible childhood, and she was the victim of incest by the hands of her father. She was terribly. Terribly damaged. And as a result, we were victimized by that. She loved us. You just never knew who you were going to get. You know,
right. Sure. Yeah. It's interesting though. Cause you know, you're a guy and I'm the same way. Like, I feel like I don't know who, like for most of my life, I didn't know who the fuck I was, but like when you watch like an old piece of work you did, can't you see yourself? I mean, like after a certain point, like I started to realize, like, how am I the only one that doesn't know who I am? Because I'm the same guy. Like, I can see it in there. There's parts of me that never change, which means to me that I was somebody, that I had a self, but for some reason living in it, I couldn't quite identify it.
No, I don't think so. There's a lot. I never liked watching myself. You know, and now that I'm an old man, to see my new, you know, the more recent stuff, that the way my body is, and I'm leaning over and I'm rotting away. You know, it's like I can't stomach it. It's Billy Wilder was quoted as saying, "Is some of my work I loathe less than others?"
Yeah, you feel that way?
Oh, I totally feel that way.
So when did you like when you're at work and like when you did Risky Business, you know, Tom Cruise a big star yet or he wasn't, was he?
No.
So like you didn't know what was going to happen with that movie. You're just taking a job.
That's right. taking a job. And I, you know, and at that time they were doing all these kid movies, and it was, for me, it was just 2 weeks work.
And that was a big deal. That kind of broke you, didn't it?
Well, yeah, it's like, what the hell? I couldn't believe it. That it was that successful. Like, what the hell happened? Yeah. And that became my kind of connection with Warner Brothers for years. I went from one Warner Brothers picture, and you know, with success, the Fugitive and Matrix. I did a lot of the Goonies. So it was risky business to the Goonies.
Yeah.
And the Goonies to the Fugitive, and the Fugitive to the Matrix, and you know, and then, and those are the ones that made money. I'm not mentioning the shitbox ones.
Right, but you were in La Bamba. That did all right. I saw it.
That was a huge. That was it. Yeah, and that was Taylor Hackford.
Again.
He introduced it. So, yeah. You know, it's like you make the one thing that I've been very lucky about is that these guys like me enough to hire me again.
Yeah.
That's the one fucking thing, because it's certainly not talent.
No, you bring the juice, man. You're fucking Joe Pantoliano.
My daughter, she says, she just made me change my Instagram.
Yeah.
And it's, I say, I'm no actor and I got over 100 movies to prove it.
when you were doing Empire of the Sun, could you ever have imagined that Christian Bale would be who he is now?
No. I could never imagine him being 20. We actually just saw that movie for the first time. You know, last week we did a Goonie reunion. Uh-huh. Everybody. Josh Gad, he put together, so it was like Spielberg and Donner and Chris Columbus and all the Goonie kids and me and Robert Dobby, the Fratelli family, you know, one of those Skype things, everybody's
yeah,
talking.
Yeah.
And so after doing that, it was really cool to do it. It felt really good. And so my family and I watched the Goonies.
Yeah.
And they said, this is really, it's really great. This is a really fun movie. And I said, you know, we got to watch. So the next night we watched Empire of the Sun. I haven't seen Empire of the Sun in 30 years.
Yeah.
And my kids were like, who's that kid? Holy shit.
Yeah.
It's like, it's the experience that I remember, not the acting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
you're
talking about, oh yeah, I was in China and I had to get, I went to China. We shot 4 weeks in China, and yeah. I had to drive a truck. It was a double clutch truck.
Right.
And so the Chinese, this is 1987. The Chinese made me get a driver's license. They wouldn't let me drive the truck unless I had a driver's license. Right. I was the first American to have a driver's license in China, and I left it there. Idiot that I am.
You don't have your Chinese driver's license anymore?
No. No. How cool is that?
Well, now you can drive a double clutch truck too.
Yeah, yeah, if I could find that thing.
But you remember him as a kid though, Christian Bale.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. The whole family. They're adorable. They came to our wedding, Nancy and I. We got married 26 years ago. That was Christian in his awkward stage, you know, 16 years old.
Right.
6'3".
That's fun. Are you still in touch with him now?
I saw him a while ago. We were in a shopping mall, and this guy comes up. He goes, "Jerry, it's Christian," and he says, "I want you to introduce you to my wife." You know, he's adorable. He's a good kid. He's a good man. He's a good man.
Yeah, and good actor, huh?
Yeah, he's an amazing actor. And I didn't know. I mean, all I remember. I told this to my kids. All I remember from that experience is how Steven Spielberg would have him running around before he said action. He'd get him on a bicycle. So the kid was always out of breath. And that's one of the few things that I remember about that whole entire experience. I remember we couldn't eat either because we were in a concentration camp.
Yeah.
So I was like living in Spain for two months, and I was living in London and China, and we couldn't eat. We were on these strict diets because we couldn't put on weight.
And that must have been terrible, all the good food around, right?
All around you. I mean, Spain, those Spanish people are crazy. They don't go out to dinner until 3 a.m.
I know. It's food, and everything's like a small plate of everything, but there's hundreds of them.
Yeah.
So, and then like, and then another memory I have is that that Midnight Run character is hilarious. And they really, that was one of those characters where you could go completely crazy, right?
That was an interesting thing because Marty, you know, Marty Press was somebody I knew from the NYU days when they were students, right?
Yeah, right.
So he calls me up and says, hey, listen, I'm doing this movie. That, take a look at these two characters. You could play either one of them. Pick what you like. So I didn't like it. I said, I don't want to do that, Marty. I want to do something different. I've done that before. Well, what do you want to do? I said, I want to play the accountant. He started laughing. He said, that ain't going to happen. I said, well, the only other part then is the, you know, the bail bondsman. He goes, no. The bail bondsman, I got this other thing in mind. I want the guy to be really, really fat. He says, if you want that part, you got to win it. You got to come in and audition. I said, sure. I'm, you know. So they said, you're reading with Robert De Niro. And, you know, I worked on it. And because of my dyslexia, for years, I had always memorized the part, but then pretended I was reading because I didn't want them to think
right.
I was giving my best, this is my best A game.
So you had to act it. You had to act on top of acting.
Yes. And I'm reading with De Niro. And at one point he's asking for money. He says, where's my money, Eddie? Give me my money. And he puts out his hand. Like, you know, give me the money.
Yeah.
And I took his hand and I shake his hand. I put his hand up to my chest. And I started petting his hand. I said, what's, and my line was, what's the matter with you? You don't trust me? And I'm like I'm making love to him. What's the right. matter with you? You don't trust me? Come over here. You're going to get you. You know, instead of like another actor would say, what's the matter? You don't trust me. Get out of here. So I saw De Niro's eyes go like this.
Yeah.
Like he was like, whoa. Who's this guy? And I felt really good. It was one of the only times I remember like feeling like I got the job in the room.
And was that the first time you met De Niro?
I think officially. I used to see him in the village because, of course, I knew who he was. I had a small part in Godfather 2. We were on 6th Street between Avenue A and B. They took that whole street and turned it into 1920 New York Street. And we were in a tenement building, and those apartments were turned into dressing rooms. And I accidentally walked into his dressing room one day. I thought I was going into mine, and there he was. He was sitting there reading his script. So I'd seen him around. I used to see him downtown at the bookstore. But that was the first time I officially met him as an actor.
Did you guys hit it off pretty good?
I liked him. Yeah. He was incredibly interesting to work with then. I mean, he was, you know, that young De Niro had a mystique and allure that he was incredibly concentrated but he was incredibly giving actor. Would, you know, knock on my door and say, you want to run lines and stuff like that, it was always about, you know, doing a good job in the work and totally accessible. So I adored him.
When after you do Midnight Run and you start to do, I don't remember when you did the Bad Boy movies, but I mean, you just never stopped. Oh, The Fugitive was probably before that.
Yeah. You know, it has nothing to do with talent. It has to do with movies making money.
Right.
You know, back then it was like, this movie is a hit. Okay, he's in it. Boom. Like, you know, now I'm in the biggest hit movie in the world. Bad Boys for Life has been the number one movie. It's broken all records because of the coronavirus. See, it's the last movie that's in the theaters. So nothing has come out. And because of that, I am in the number one movie in the history of the world. And I can't get hired. We're all out of work.
Who were you in Godfather 2?
I was, my part was cut out. Remember the guy, Fanucci, the guy in the white?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a scene where he is attacked. When Coppola, years later, put together the Godfather saga where he took all three movies and so I'm in that, but I was one of three guys that jumped him and cut his throat.
No kidding.
Yeah, it was a really cool scene because he's all in white and they cut his throat. We cut his throat.
Oh yeah, because they refer to that.
Yes. By the way, I'll tell you a funny story. I was working at O'Neill's Balloon, Patrick O'Neill's restaurant across from American Ballet Theater, Lincoln Center. Yeah. I was a waiter there. And one day these guys show up and they got 16 millimeter cameras. And I go, what are you guys doing? They go, well, we're shooting some B-roll. I said, oh, you're filmmakers? I'm an actor. And they go, no, we're doing a movie. We're looking, we're scouting locations for a movie that's coming in from Hollywood. I said, well, you got anything in there for me? And he said, well, not really. You know, it's all old people. But you're an actor. Maybe you know we're looking for a good casting director. So I only knew one casting director, Vic Ramos, who I'd done extra work for. I said, Vic Ramos, the best casting director in the whole world. So a couple of weeks later, he calls me up. He goes, I'll be a son of a bitch. I've never gotten an extra, got me a job. But I just got this thing called Harry and Tonto with Art Carney. And there's nothing in it. It's all old people, but I owe you one. So now he calls me up 6-7 months later. He goes, look, I'm doing this movie for Pete's sake with Barbara Streisand. Peter Yates is directing it. You know, the guy that did Bullet. Yeah, yeah. He says, well, you're going to work for me. I'm going to give you a voucher a day and you'll take care. You're going to wrangle the extras. And if there's a small part or something, you know, maybe we get you. So one day Peter Yates goes, yeah, who's playing the undercover cop? And I said, me. He says, all right, come on. I was in my street clothes.
Yeah.
So I get the job. I arrest Barbara Streisand. The year goes by. I need to get my W-4. I call Vic. He says, come over. And all of these guys there's all these guys dressed like Marlon Brando, right?
Yeah.
The hair slicked back. It's 1974. And he goes, Joey, I got it over here. I go, wait a minute, Joey, wait. He goes, do you do stunts? I go, yeah.
Sure, why not?
And he goes, all right, come and meet Fred Roos. So Fred Roos goes, you do stunts? Yeah. You're an actor? Yeah. When you study, to tell him, I get hired. Now, it's my job, apparently, that I'm going to come from nowhere and jump on the back of this guy, Benucci.
Yeah.
And we're on 6th Street in the back alley, and it's all this broken glass and condoms and, you know, IV needles. And Coppola says, where's the stunt guy? And I guess I was a little green because I saw that Fred Roos, the producer, immediately knew that I was a lying sack of shit. And he pointed at me like, that's the stunt guy. So I must have been shaking because Coppola takes me, he goes, I want you to jump off of the first floor fire escape onto this guy's back. And I said, okay. And he looked at me and he said, that's pretty high, huh? I said, yeah. And he said, all right, just come from around the building. So he knew. And, you know, somebody else would have said, get this fucking guy out of here and get me a stuntman. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he didn't do that. And that's what I'm talking about. Those kind of happy, good luck moments in your life that, you know, enabled me to meet Robert De Niro and all of these people. And holy shit.
Well, he was like, Coppola was a pretty manic guy before he got, you know, his diagnosis for his medicine. Was he wild to watch on set?
No. You know.
Very calm?
Very, very commanding, you know, very calm.
Yeah. I guess maybe it was Apocalypse Now that put him over.
Oh, yeah, right?
Yeah. Did you ever work with Dennis Hopper?
I did. I worked with Dennis Hopper on a movie in Las Vegas, and he was wonderful to work with. Peter Weller, Dennis, me, I think Tia Carrera, Howard Fuhrer directed it.
What movie? You remember?
I forget the name of it. But the cool thing that I remember is we were shooting nights, and it happened to be the night we were on. We went on the roof to see them implode the Sands Hotel, which was maybe 300 yards away, 400.
Yeah, yeah.
And we saw the Sands Hotel come down. That was amazing.
You hate Vegas. It must have been a good night for you. But your parents weren't the kind of people that went to Vegas, right?
No. Yeah. My mom was a bookie. She, this summer, the way we were able to go down the Jersey Shore, she'd work for these bookies. And so she had a territory that would play the numbers,
Yeah.
The boarding house, the Newark boarding house, the East Orange boarding house, the Jersey City boarding house, and the Hoboken boarding house.
What about Tommy Lee Jones? He's a good guy?
I love him. I love him. I think I learned more about acting from that guy, because he's so good, and he's so smart. But his intellect, he's able to separate his intellect from his spontaneity, his ability to be so spontaneous. And I just adored working with him. Yeah, I've worked with him 3 times. I've done 3 movies with him.
Yeah, it's the same character, right? It was all the Fugitive.
No, I did the Fugitive twice, and then we did a movie with a Ron Shelton movie a couple of years ago. Morgan Freeman and Tommy Lee.
It was good.
George Wallace.
George Wallace, the comedian?
Yes.
What the hell movie was that?
I think they changed the name of it.
The Feast of the Seven Fishes?
No.
The Brawler? No. Oh, maybe this is it. Just Getting Started. That's it.
Okay. I never saw it. I've never seen any of those movies you just mentioned.
With Rene Russo? Rene Russo was in it?
Yeah,
too?
I never saw it.
Wait. That's so. Did you have a lot of? Was you a big scenes in it? Your big part?
I was there for a while. Yeah, I just it's like
you're not gonna watch it, but you do like. So you're a guy like you're like me though. Like I don't. You like doing it, and that's enough. What do you got?
That's enough, and you're only going to be disappointed.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like, well, they did this, they took that out.
Right.
I suck. Pretty much, I lead with I
but
suck.
But what about the fucking Sopranos? You got to be proud of that.
Well, I didn't see that either.
Come on. What are you, crazy?
I don't have HBO to this day.
Come on. You didn't watch yourself play that guy?
That guy was a horrible person. incredibly fun. But very complicated guy, very, very nasty guy.
Yeah, he was fucking horrendous. Fucking horrendous.
Yep.
But he got it. He got it.
None of my kids are allowed to watch it.
None of them.
Traumatic. It would be traumatic. Yeah. They can't separate. That's what's beautiful about movies is, it's a fucking movie because it's not happening. It's happening on your TV.
Yeah.
You absolutely know. But you get involved. You believe these people.
Yeah.
Good ones. And
yeah.
So it's like, like you said, it's the joy that in the moments that there's those little moments where in between action and cut, where you go, what? Somebody says cut, and you go, the fuck was that? Like what just happened? And then you get these directors that was perfect. Do it again, just like that. I don't know what the fuck I just did. What's he talking about?
But that they kept you on. Usually, they kind of churn through guys in one season, the bad guys. But you were on for 2 seasons because they got a lot out of you.
David called me up. He says, it's 2 years work. You come in, you go up against Tony. This is all he said to me. I remember exactly. He says, he's a scumbag, but they're all scumbags. And then in the end, you're going to lose out to Tony. And, it's 2 seasons.
That's it?
That's all he said. I did that thing. I was on it for 2 months.
Yeah.
And I get a script and it says that I'm a coke addict. I'm a drug addict. Nobody ever said I was a coke addict. I never played that.
Yeah.
I didn't know this guy had an issue with drugs until I read about it. And I said, I just did four episodes. I could have used that. He goes,
Did you end up playing it later?
There's one scene where I'm doing coke and yelling at Kirk Douglas.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's right. But, like, what was it like in terms of these guys that you, like, Tommy Lee Jones, you could sort of learn stuff from him as an actor. What was it like working with Gandolfini? He seems pretty good.
He was amazing. They're a lot alike. Jimmy was incredibly sensitive, and also the most generous guy I'd ever known in my life. And this is a projection on my part, but becoming that kind of iconic TV star, but was I think is somewhat confusing to him, and how you know how people changed around him was somewhat confusing to him. Like what the, you know, because he would always say, "I don't know what the fucking noise is about. I'm just some fat guy from Jersey,"
right?
You know, but so much fun and you know, challenge, because you know, he kept you on your toes theatrically. You never you know, you never knew who you were going to get. It was always fresh and always new. And then you have these smart editors that take all these bits and pieces and turn it into great stuff.
So when after you do that guy Ralph in The Sopranos, like I you know, I imagine that more than any other thing you did, you know, because you were on, you got so much screen time that people who watch The Sopranos, which was everybody except for you, you know, had a
relief. There's still room for a fan out there. Then, yeah, there's one holdout. Here I come.
But I imagine that people recognize you from that more than anything. What was the reaction to, that people had to that guy? I can't imagine that. There's some probably some guys like you grew up with who are like, there he is. But like, we're...
No, you know what? Well, by the time I got The Sopranos, I'd already done Memento. I'd already done Bound. I'd already done The Matrix.
Oh, right. So,
So it was a, you know, a cluster. Depending on the demographic and the cultural backgrounds of these, you know, the fans,
right?
You know, the college kids loved Memento, you know, you had the African Americans love The Matrix and the Bad Boys movies, and a lot of the college kids loved that. And then you got the tri-staters. You know, I usually get the Soprano stuff more in the New York area.
Philly, Jersey, New York.
East Coast, yeah, East Coast.
yeah. And what is the reaction usually to him?
Well, it's like they call you by the character name.
Yeah, of course.
You know, like they'll say, "Hey, I'm really sorry about Tony."
Yeah,
you know? And that used to piss me off when they would call me by the character name.
Yeah.
What's my name? I would say, "What's my name? Well, who am I? What's my name?" And they go, "Oh, relax, relax."
really? You think that you're going to kill him?
Yeah. I would be, you know, and Jimmy and Stevie Van Sant, Michael Imperioli would say, "Hey, Joey, you know, these are your fans. They're paying the fucking rent. The customer's always right."
Yeah. And I imagine that women probably gave you a dirty look.
No, on the contrary. Women, I remember after that scene
where you killed this, you killed a stripper.
No, I killed this. I killed an underage stripper,
pregnant stripper.
My child.
Yeah.
My child, and I was looking at a store on Fifth Avenue. A couple of days later, I was looking in the window.
Yeah.
And somebody taps me on the shoulder, and it startled me. I turned around, and it was this nice blue-haired old lady.
Yeah.
She said, "Well, I wanted to say hello because I love your work, but I guess you're not as tough as the guy you play on television." Yeah. You know, after I did Sopranos, I wanted to change up.
You didn't want to be
that adversity. So I did. Yeah. I produced and acted in the movie Marcia Gay Harden was in, called Canvas, about an Italian American family who's introduced to mental illness and how mental illness affects the whole family, not just the diagnoses.
Is there something you wrote?
No. A guy named Joe Greco wrote and directed it, but it was something that I wanted to marshal in because I'd been getting slapped around. Well, we were all getting slapped around by these Italian American Anti-Defamation Leagues, you know, and I was like, "Hey, they didn't want you to take the job. Like, what are you guys nuts?" And so,
what do you mean by Italians?
Yeah, there was a whole period where these Italian American Defamation Leagues were going after the Sopranos and David and the actors for even being a part of something that was that good, but they thought it defamed Italian Americans.
Huh.
But, And I always thought that what I loved about The Sopranos was that if The Godfather was about the birth of family, the American family,
yeah,
and honor, The Sopranos was about the deconstruction of the of the family, the falling apart.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really liked that. So any opportunity, that's why, you know, the movie that I got coming out from The Vine,
yeah,
which was an opportunity to play this Italian American character who's a lawyer who winds up working in a factory and then has an awakening with what he's doing for a living and goes back to his home country in Italy. So I got to work in Italy with Italian actors, and it was a bilingual movie, and it was a lot of fun for me to get an opportunity like that, because the movies that kind of really gave me most value were these little independent movies like La Bamba and Bound and Memento. In those days, you know, these $2-4 million movies, where they couldn't get movie stars to play those parts. So a guy like me was able to get those parts. And the same thing with technology as it is today. This movie that we made in Italy, you know, for like $1 million, but the technology is such that you can do it, and it's less financial risk for the producers. And that a guy like me, they don't need some movie star, $2 million movie star, so I can come in and get to play it, these good parts.
So what was the thing about Canvas that was so revelatory to you?
It was the idea that when someone's mind breaks, and someone that you love has changed in a way that she no longer can be reached, and then you have a 10-year-old boy and you're stuck in the middle of how do you get somebody help that doesn't think they need it?
Yeah.
You know, crazy people, we don't think we're crazy.
Right, you know? Right, right.
And actually, that was the conduit that when Marcia Gay started working, I remember the first thought was like, who does she remind me of? And then I realized it was my mother, because I never thought my mother was nuts. I just thought she was Italian.
Yeah.
You know, so I just thought it was a ethnic thing. I didn't think it was mental.
Right,
you
right.
know?
Yeah.
And so I was like, wait a minute. If that's the case, then it's not her fault. It wasn't my mother's fault. And then maybe this is not my fault.
Huh. That's interesting. So it was through the work on that film that was sort of the portal into you forgiving your mother and yourself and sort of reframing your entire life in a kind of a more empathetic, through a more empathetic lens.
Yeah, it became the thing where I asked for help. It was like something, I'm hurting, it hurts. I was sucking down 20 Vicodin a day and didn't, I couldn't understand why I was so depressed. And I was, you know, I'd look out my window and, you know, and I'm, you know, in my dream house, I'm making money. I just won an Emmy Award. All of the things that I thought were going to, you know, make this feeling go away.
Right.
And I was like, and I had this, like, I want to die. Mm. Why do I want to die? It was like fascinating. Why? You got everything you want and now you want to kill yourself? What's up? What's wrong with you?
Yeah. And now, so what did you start to do? You went to therapy or you worked it through you?
Well, I had to, you know, I had a history, heart disease in my family before I found out my father was my father. So it turns out the good news is I don't have heart disease. Good news, you don't have heart disease. The bad news is you're going to live to your 80.
Yeah, yeah. So
I, you know, I went there and the doc said, how you doing? EKG's okay. How you feeling? I said, you know, I feel like I'm like underwater. I feel like I'm walking through quicksand.
And yeah, yeah.
And he said, oh, yeah, well, you know, wrong department. here's these three or four guys you can call.
Wrong department.
So I found a guy, a doctor, and that started the journey. And so as I started, I didn't know I had a drug problem. I didn't know I was alcoholic. I didn't know I was crazy. I didn't know any of those things.
Yeah.
I just knew that I don't have energy. I got to get my energy back.
That was
it. Doesn't everybody want to kill themselves? I mean,
I thought anybody who's smart wants to kill themselves, right?
So, the thing that the doctor, one day the doctor, I'm talking, and he goes, he's nodding his head. Dr. Kelly, his name was, and he was half Jewish and half Irish, and he had the map of Ireland on his face, but he talked like this, that Jewish New Jersey thing. And he said, you're not going to like hearing this, but your first waking conscious thought in the morning is, fuck, I'm still here.
Yeah.
And I started sobbing. I just, and for the next 6 months, that's all I did. And all this pain, I didn't know where it was coming from. To this day, I really don't know where it was coming from, putting it all together. And I think also 9/11, when 9/11 happened, something, it was like a fault line. Something got shook.
Yeah.
And all of that emotional dust and unresolved traumatic events that happened in the course of my lifetime all came crashing at me. And that's when I started doing the drugs in a serious way. They got hold of me. And at that point, I was about like the country Western song, about to lose everything.
Yeah.
But then I surrendered, kind of thing.
But you were able to do that grieving, right? You were able to, you keep crying. That's the trick, right? Mm-hmm. Shit, man. Like, once it started coming up, you let it keep coming, huh?
Yeah. It's like, and I luckily I had people and, mentors again. I had a good doctor and I had an AA sponsor that would just say nothing. They're just like, non-judgmental.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's great, man. Because I feel it. I feel like I need to somehow figure out how to let all that go, because I stop myself from the crying, I toughen up around it. Mm-hmm. But I don't, because I know it needs to happen. I don't, again, like you said, I don't know what for, but I know it needs to happen someplace, and not just during, movies or a sad commercial. Mm-hmm. So I got to figure out, the tears squeak out, I got to put my cat down. That's going to fucking send me over the edge. But I know there's an abundance of it down there.
But the thing is I talk about this a lot with my family. It's like, if I tell you a joke and I make you laugh, that's an emotion.
Yeah.
So why are we discriminating against pain? Why is pain devalued or shamed? Why, if I, making you cry or making you laugh or making you angry, why is it okay to have those feelings and not have the pain?
Well, I think that, laughing and maybe a little bit of discomfort's probably a little more acceptable socially. You don't want to go to a party and try to upset everybody. Make everybody cry. I mean, I think it's a context thing. You know what I mean? I mean, it's not a great defense to be standing there in front of in a room full of your family, all of them crying, and you're yelling, going like, "This is what we need to be doing." Yeah.
That's what wakes and weddings are for.
No, I see what you're saying, though, that there is a discomfort. I've talked about it before. I think that at some point, we lost the ability to realize that, it's fairly easy to be there for people, because a lot of times all you have to do is listen. But sometimes for some reason, people think that other people's problems are a burden. So people become ashamed of their problems, right? So they don't want to talk about them because they don't want to burden people. And it's just this weird thing about the pace of life or people's priorities, because a lot of times, all you got to do is stand there. And listen to a guy. And then that's it, feel what you're going to feel. But if they need to talk or they need to cry or whatever, you stand there and you go, okay, you better. Okay. Well, let me know. Call me again if you need to. But for some reason, that people don't do that.
Well, that's, I mean, this wasn't happening during dinner parties. It, you know, was like
Right.
in safe environments, in 12-step rooms.
Right.
And in fact, in the 12, you know, in the AA rooms,
Yeah.
because, you know, the my guy would say, "Hey, look, you know, just call it alcoholism."
Yeah,
They said,
right.
"It's, you're crazy, but, you know, call it alcoholism." So people would grab him later and say, "Hey, look, get this guy's fucking nuts. Get him out of here." And my guy was, ex-cop, Irish,
Yeah.
6'5".
Yeah.
So they were gonna fuck with him. And he'd say,
Yeah.
"Don't worry about him. I got him. Don't worry about him."
He'll level off. And you did, huh?
Yeah, thank God.
Yeah. Hey, buddy, it's great talking to you. I'm looking forward to seeing the new movie. I watched a little a trailer of it. It looks nice. Looks
Thanks.
sweet. Are you
Yeah,
going to
thanks.
watch it?
I've actually seen that one.
Oh,
Yeah, I've seen
really?
that one. I've actually seen that one, and it's pretty good. I like it a lot. It's just what the country needs. It's about life and love, and not about making money. Where this guy was making a lot of money, and he realized, he's got a daughter that hates him and a wife that doesn't love him anymore, and he didn't even know it. So it's great, it's fun, and there's a lot of great actors in it.
Did you feel like that was those are themes that you could understand?
Oh yeah, I told the director, I said, "Look, I don't they hired me right quick." I said, "Look, this is going to be a documentary. I don't have time to put together a character."
Does it take time for you to put together characters?
Well, sometimes when they're really complicated, but this guy is in a lot of ways closest to who I really am.
And how do
You
you,
know,
but how do you do that? How do you put the, like, you know, what determines what, how do you go about putting together a complicated character?
well, you know, in, you investigate, based on the given circumstances, like the little clues, what other characters are saying about you.
Right.
When I was doing The Sopranos, I remember I noticed I'd done three or four scenes, and I noticed that every time that I hit somebody or
Yeah.
hurt somebody, that somehow they it was a reaction to them starting it. They all came at me first. And
Right.
I said to David Chase, I said, "Hey, David, I noticed this about the guy. What do you think?" And he said, "Well, sounds, whatever. Yeah, run with it." But with the girl, with the girlfriend,
Yeah.
she becomes very vulnerable in that scene, and she says, "I'm going to name the baby something." And I go, "Oh, great. And if it's a girl, we can name the baby after you, so she could grow up to be a cock-sucking slut just like her mother."
Right.
And she hits me. I got her
Wow.
to hit me, and then that gave me permission to retaliate. And
Right.
that was a big clue for this guy. And you can make stuff up. You can create a set idea and say, "Okay, this is why he's that way," or this is
Right, 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 right. Yeah. That's so funny because that's sort of like it's that thing about the permission, like, it's like your mother pushing your buttons until she got to be able to sing.
Yeah.
You
Yeah.
just keep poking at people until they snap, and then you go, "Oh, you're gonna do that? Fuck you." Yeah. I tell you, I feel better. I think we got a lot accomplished. I feel like I got a meeting in. That's good.
Well, thank you. I really enjoy listening to you, and I think you're a terrific actor. I loved you on your show,
Oh,
and
thanks,
I
man.
thought that was a very complicated, interesting character, and I was very jealous, so that means you were very good.
Well, thank you very much. The more I talk to guys like you, and the more I sort of think about the job of acting, since I'm relatively new to it, in the sense I've been a comic my whole life. Like I'm starting to appreciate it more, after having conversations, like even this conversation. Like I think I can bring more to that guy. I was set to start shooting the day that they closed it down for the last season. So I was looking forward to getting involved with that. But thank you for saying that, and thank you for some of the acting tips.
Thank you.
Joey Pants, Jersey. Glad he's okay. I am okay. I don't know if the country's okay. kind of hope our president's not okay. The twitching and the jerking. What's up? I guess I shouldn't wish ill on anybody. But God damn it, something's got to give. Okay? Sad guitar still. Still sad guitar.